Welcome to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. Today, I'm chatting with Eric Mieres about the psychological impact of technology use in cyber warfare. Eric is a retired Army Sergeant Major, a former US Marine and Army Special Operations Intelligence professional, and is currently a PhD student in cyber psychology, focusing on the psychological and cognitive effects of offensive cyber and computer network operations. Welcome, Eric. I'm so delighted to have you on board.
Thank you, Caroline. I appreciate the opportunity.
Eric, before we get chatting about your PhD research and your work, can you tell me a little bit more about who you are and what the pivotal point was that sent you down the road of cyber psychology?
Excellent. I appreciate that question. So it's essentially, my parents immigrated from Cuba. My mom was pregnant, and we ended up coming to Hialeah, Florida, where I was born. And I was essentially raised in a Cuban culture. But at the time I was 18, I realized that the streets of Miami were pretty rough. And I wanted to join the military, move out, and sort of give back to the nation that welcomed us with almost open arms. So I went and joined the Marine Corps, did infantry for about 6 years. And then around 1997, decided I wanted to transfer over to the Army and pursue a career in intelligence. And so that was sort of the beginning of sort of dabbling in technology and in this high cognitive work. And during that process, I was able to earn my bachelor's and my master's in cybersecurity during the global war on terrorism, which was not easy. And towards retirement, right before COVID, decided to pursue a second master's in cyber intelligence. But unfortunately, due to COVID, I wasn't able to finish it. And I remember my young son at this point was 14 years old. Was excited because I was no longer traveling, but now I was highly engaged in school at home, and I couldn't finish my master's. And one day I'm here in my study, and he comes to me and he's like, "Hey, Dad, when are you going to finish your PhD?" And I was like, "Wait a minute, I don't remember ever talking about a PhD directly to him." And that sparked in me this sort of, I think this is what I want to do. If I have my 14-year-old asking me about accomplishing this goal, then I need to do it.
And you are the 2023 Tillman Scholar at the Pat Tillman Foundation. Can you talk a bit more about this and what you do with the Pat Tillman Foundation?
Absolutely. So first of all, it's an absolute honor, and I am humbled to be among, right now, there's 1,000 Pat Tillman Scholars since 2004. And so Pat Tillman was an NFL player that right after September 11 decided he wanted to join the military, joined the military, and sadly in 2004 was killed in Afghanistan. Shortly after, his family and the rest of his community stood up the Pat Tillman Foundation, which honored Pat's incredible career, his drive, his motivation, his love for education. And then established this wonderful Pat Tillman family of scholars.
So your PhD is funded by the National Defense and Science Engineering Graduate Fellowship through the Army Research Office and focuses on a very specific area, which is the understanding of the cognitive and psychological impact of technology use by those in special operations, especially in the area of cyber warfare. Could you talk about why this is such a very important area of research?
So right now, from my understanding, I'm one of the first NDSG fellows leveraging cyber psychology. And in particular, the NDSG, as you pointed, does fund my research. And so in 2022, I had to apply. And essentially, you're looking at the military's requirements for future research. And what I had leveraged was two specific research groups. One was from the conventional Army that had requirements on cognition and certain other cyber requirements. And within special operations as well, cognition. So when I put my application in, I said, "Hey, I think we're missing this aspect of understanding the cognitive and psychological adverse impacts on cyber operators, and in particular, those that work within special operations." And fortunately, I was actually awarded the fellowship, which funds it and provides me access to a community of other researchers.
And you spent 29 years in the military, with 23 of those years engaged in intelligence work. And the layperson might imagine warfare being very physically demanding, but you spoke in one of your blog posts about the kind of intellectual, emotional, and psychological impact of the work you carried out. Can you tell me a little bit more about how your role in intelligence was emotionally and cognitively draining?
Absolutely. So yeah, 29 years. As I mentioned, the beginning, those first 6 years were actually in the Marine Corps, and that was predominantly in infantry work. At that time, this was before September 11, so this was in the reserves. So yeah, there was, you know, jumping out of airplanes, doing a lot of physical tasks, always focused on sort of the mindset of an infantryman that can be, or a Marine that can be deployed around the world. And then when I transferred to the Army, fortunately, I was able to go into intelligence and first started a career as a linguist. So the military actually taught me how to learn languages, which was great. And then the follow-on training was in specialized technical intelligence. And so this is around like 1998, went to the first unit, which was in Special Forces as a support intelligence professional. And then later on, I would move on to a unique organization that I would then spend the next 20 years. And that was a combination of still doing very physical operator type work, but as well as high cognitive work in the intelligence field, which was around languages, was around learning technology, it was learning tradecraft, it was constantly consuming large amounts of information and working with some really highly technical equipment, if you would, from equipment where we listened to voice conversations, and then we moved on to learning, you know, emails and radio frequency finding. And that was a unique balance between the physical world of being an operator and at the same time having to engage in this high cognitive work, which I submit during that time, we weren't very aware of how much, in particular in the global war on terrorism, how much technology played a role in our work. And long story short, by the time I started to retire, when I was able to reflect back on my career, I realized that there was additional impact that wasn't only on the muscular skeletal. It wasn't only on sort of this known post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injuries, but in fact, it was cognitive. It was just, you know, high use of or lack of cognitive bandwidth by the time I was done.
Imagine that. And it sounds like it's an all body, all brain experience, which is kind of, It's one thing having really cognitive role and another thing having a really physical role, but actually having a combination of both has an additional strain on you as a person and as a human being, really.
It does. And in particular, when there are unique roles where some will focus on technical work, and that can be accomplished in certain government facilities or military bases, and in that individual's career will predominantly be technically focused. But there are unique roles where you're taking that knowledge of technology and then you're applying it back in the physical world. So, you know, from a cyber psychology perspective, you know, this offline online world, if you looked at that way, there are certain individuals in the military that their roles are predominantly offline, and then there's some that are online. For example, cyber operators, drone operators, and a couple of other ones. But then there's the uniqueness of having to go back and forth between sort of these, you know, your online self and your offline self from a military or an intelligence capacity.
And this leads me into the next question, which is about, during our initial conversation, you spoke about your PH journey being a very personal one for you. Why was this so personal?
So it was really personal, and it stems sadly from the suicide of two of my friends. And many of our teammates, and it happened just as I was retiring, and it was a reflection point. To that point, I was very knowledgeable of other individuals that died in combat. I myself had sustained injuries, but essentially it was part of the job to you lose two people, and looking at it from a technology or mechanical perspective, we couldn't put it back together. You couldn't put these operators back together. And And for me, just reflecting on it was, okay, is it traumatic brain injury? Was it post-traumatic stress? But then in reflecting later on, it was, well, maybe it was attributed to this high cognitive work that we did, this constant immersion of technology, languages, and all these other things. And so that became really personal. And in combination, in 2019, as I was getting to retire, I was fortunate to go to the National Intrepid Center of Excellence for Traumatic Brain Injury. It's a month-long program. And essentially, they just diagnose you from a multiple disciplines, not only for TBIs, but all the way from teaching you yoga to music to mindfulness to looking at your blood. And in there, I learned that I was out of cognitive bandwidth. It was one of the first things that one of the neuropsychs told me. He's like, hey, you're out of it. You've, between the bumps and bruises and between this high engagement in this work that you've done, you're tapped out, which essentially could lead to post-traumatic stress, which could lead to suicide ideation. Again, and that was when I got that diagnosed, that became very surreal for me. And lastly, as I was exiting the military and started to do some initial research, as I was doing veteran advocacy and trying to kind of share my story and understand not only the physical world, the bumps and bruises from it, but this unique cognitive work that we really don't talk about in the military, and found some illuminating papers, which will then would set the course of my PhD journey.
So going back to kind of the emotional and cognitive element of the role in special operations, specifically for those involved in cyber warfare, what are the emotional and mental skills that kind of person needs to do their job well? And how does this work directly impact their cognitive and psychological well-being in the short and long term?
So interesting. So for DoD or for the intelligence community, we have cyberspace operations. And then I'm going to give you like a quick caption of like 25 years, right? So there's multiple things that have evolved in cyberspace operations. So offensive cyber operations is more what we relate to what the military does, and also what the intelligence community did was computer network operations, sort of the I'm going to go steal secrets from our adversaries, where the offensive would be I'm going to go take down a tank or a server. And so from the intelligence side, it is culturally part of you're part of an organization, and you're understanding that's what that organization does. We go and we steal secrets and we bring them back, and there's a uniqueness to this. And then when you look at it from a military or from an attack perspective, you are now engaging in warfare through online, right? Through a keyboard and a mouse and a monitor. And so that, I believe, and this is part of my research, is that we don't understand that well. We don't, similar to we understand the physiology and psychology of putting a pilot in an F-35, we understand what it is to put a submariner in a submarine and put them, underneath the ocean, but we don't quite understand what it is to prepare individuals to engage in some form of warfare or cyber operations online. The uniqueness, I believe, with special operations, which is where a lot of my background came, is in support of real-time operations. It's not only from a tactical perspective, but it can also be operational to strategic. And in many cases, because of sort of the world of special operations, is okay, that's great. We're doing cyber operations, but let's take it forward. Let's take these technologies, these capabilities, and let's do it in a combat zone or a non-permissive. So you are essentially trying to develop or create individuals that have a special operations mindset with their own unique skills, but now you're taking, again, something that has traditionally been known to be conducted in sanctuary cyber operations, and then merge them and do them forward. And so for me and for those that I worked with, that was a very unique emergence into sort of this world.
There's something that you mentioned while you're chatting about, we haven't really focused on these type of people who are in the military or in special forces and who are operating at that level in intelligence space. And I'm kind of guessing part of that is we just have this mindset of you go into the military, you know what you're getting into, just crack on with it, and not actually thinking about the psychological impact of it. Because we kind of think about in the war zone or in the field, you know that there's stuff that's going to happen and there's physical pain and there's boredom and there's whatever else goes on there and all the stress and anxiety that comes with that. But we don't really think about what happens behind the scenes. And we kind of, I'm guessing, slot those types of operators in a similar field to if you're in a corporate environment. You're sitting behind a computer. What on earth could go wrong? Why are you worried about the psychological impact? And I'm wondering if that's partly why we haven't thought about it. We just assume that actually that we don't think about actually they are at warfare. We kind of think of them as, oh, they're a desktop operator that kind of moves numbers around a spreadsheet. So they're fine, aren't they?
Right. Brilliant. Exactly. For me, I didn't realize, and I think I mentioned it. It was a paper that was written by the Air Force Research Laboratory in 2013, where they actually studied the remote warriors, and this is for the Air Force, and so that included intelligence professionals, drone operators, and cyber warriors. And essentially, we knew more from a military perspective that we were having concerns with drone operators because of that psychological impact, and sadly because of the high rates of suicide. I submit that was because, again, we quickly took a technology, a role, modified it. It was having a very large impact in the battlefield, and we kept on doing it. But I think then, unfortunately, when something breaks, and then we've tried to figure out, well, why did that break? Because we didn't prepare. And even to our fighter pilots and our special operators, which I'll talk later on, we've as of recent realized, oh dear, we made them strong, we can make them shoot better and swim, but there were these issues that they were having. Hopefully that answers. I'm sorry.
And also, you mentioned during our initial chat, there was a term you used called cyberspace operator syndrome. So I'm assuming that's a similar thing. But can you tell me what the syndrome is and what the warning signs are for someone who may be in danger of suffering from that syndrome?
Absolutely. So, and I'm glad you brought it up. So operator syndrome essentially was it's a paper written by Dr. Chris Free and some of his colleagues back in 2020. And Chris and his colleagues interviewed hundreds of special operators, Navy SEALs, Rangers, Green Berets, EOD, and intelligence professionals, and essentially came up with a list of the constellation of medical symptoms that if you start this life of an operator and given an amount of time, you're probably going to have these things, and they're as, you know, they're as far as traumatic brain injury, endocrine dysfunction, sleep disturbances, chronic joint pain, substance abuse, depression, suicide, anger, worry, rumination, impacts to the family, problems with sexual health, being on guard, hypervigilance, memory concentration, cognitive impairment, and vestibular vision impairments. Well, it seems like a lot, but if you kind of share that and you show that to anyone who was a special operator or anyone that was essentially in the military and went in combat, they would be like, yes, I have all of those. And it appears daunting, but it's actually kind of relieving to be able to point something and say that was the toll of the impact of my service. It's great for self-reflection. It's perfect to be able to go to a medical provider and say, because of my role, here's what I have. And as well as for family. Now, I had just about all of those, but they were still something that was troubling me as I retired. And in, as mentioned, those documents that I read about the Air Force and some other papers that focused very uniquely on cyber operators and this high cognitive work. And within those research papers, then I started to see this cognitive workload or this overload or just all of these very specific to working behind a computer, which were then not necessarily an operator syndrome. And so bottom line, I decided what I wanted to do is go, well, how do I then categorize individuals that are in this high cognitive work maybe drone operators, because there's a lot of research, and then cyber operators, so we can have our own grouping and essentially just develop. The conception would be cyberspace operator syndrome, which is a lot of what my current study focuses on, is gathering that information through my study or my literature review that has already been established of the impact to those involved in cyber operations, and or very similarly to those involved in cybersecurity, which, you know, it's all over the internet of how cybersecurity professionals suffer from stress, cognitive overload, burnout. However, it's trying to put this together for cyber operators.
That's fascinating that there's a similarity with cybersecurity professionals, because you're right, in a lot of ways, those professionals are at the forefront of a warfare against those who operate in the dark web, trying to fight for the good of the general public who feel safe, but it's those at the forefront of the cyber warfare from a cybersecurity perspective. And it's a huge responsibility for them to put up this barrier to say, here and no further, you will not harm the people behind me. That's a really fascinating perspective on it. So do you think from within that, what you're studying will then have a direct impact on those who are involved in cybersecurity in terms of how they engage with their mental health and how to help them through any PTSD or whatever they get? And I'm assuming they probably will get some element of PTSD if they're involved in a big cyber attack.
Yes, especially from a cyber attack where you're more of a target, right? So from a military perspective, that would be defensive cyber operations. Very similar to you previously had Todd Fletcher, who is studying a SOC analyst from a corporate, right? So those that work in big companies, defending the equities in those networks and based on that organization. But now you have, you know, military or from the intelligence community, from the government, that are protecting from our adversaries, who are quite literally throwing everything that they can at us, from technical means to even psychological and from social engineering to try to get into our networks. And you're that lonely team of individuals that's trying to defend from a never ending wall of attacks. And so, to your question, I believe so. Yeah, I've taken a lot of the research that came from cybersecurity, which was part of probably the last year of my literature review in diving into it, but going, okay, this is very similar, but then this is very different in regards to, you know, if you look at it, it's a person who, A, is defending things coming at them or the network. So you're in this defensive posture. And you get to be a little bit different as an individual, and I'll explain that later on, so, sort of within the cyber psychology theories or principles. But you're now an individual that needs to work in anonymity, become someone else, if you would, to then attack an adversary however you can. And so, yes, both are engaged behind a screen, looking at, you know, ones and zeros on a variety of tools, operating on a keyboard and a mouse. And which I submit that today we're still using a keyboard and a mouse and a monitor to engage in this sort of six dimensional world. So there are some principles I think that from my study can be used for those in cybersecurity, because many of them actually do come with a background. They're very similar in what we learn, the technologies. We have to learn how the internet works. We have to learn how computers work. The cybersecurity folks have to learn how the adversary to some extent thinks and operates so you can counter it. We have to, then the offensive individuals have to think of how the cybersecurity postures are in place so we can bypass them, but also not get caught. So it's this kind of chess game. But yes, I think the research could mutually benefit both sides.
And you spoke about that there is a difference. And one of the things we spoke about previously is the future of cyber warfare. And you used the term that's one keystroke being the fastest activation of warfare, and especially those cyber operators. So what do you mean by this?
So what I mean, so that's captured into what some have spoken to me about. And I finally was able to conceptualize the fear that I had by pressing that enter button. And very similar to the fear of holding a weapon in combat, your finger on the trigger or off the trigger, and then you press it, and by accident you you press the trigger and you fire a round, right? And you inadvertently hurt someone, or you hurt yourself, or you make a mistake. And so that impact of hitting that enter button is can be pretty severe. What I meant by that too was, I believe, you know, I can hit that enter button and send a ping or a command all the way around the world much faster than I think than a nuclear weapon, than a laser. I mean, you can't take it back. Once you hit that enter button, it goes. And so right now, one of the aspects of being a cyber operator that I'm focusing on is what's called a high fault intolerant environment. This is the fear that the parameters that cyber operators kind of live by. No one wants to make a mistake. You're still in the military. You're still in the intelligence community. You're high cognitive, high functioning individuals. You're perfectionist. You also have your own personalities. And in particular, that's one of the differences too between our cyber operators and sort of a black hat hacker, right? And I can cover those similarities or differences a little bit different. So that impact of hitting that enter button weighs heavily. It weighs heavily to where you will go home at night thinking about the commands you executed, the functions that you did while you were on an adversary network, where you were first probing the network. So that little button, it's how we execute our commands, right? So
that has a huge psychological impact on them. So there's obviously quite a lot of pre-work that an interactive operator needs to do in order to get to that point. And kind of hitting that keystroke. What kind of work needs to happen before they actually get to the point of hitting that button saying launch the missile or whatever they need to do?
I'm glad to say that, because it isn't as we see sort of in the movies. You know, you have a lone cyber operator as is depicted behind a keyboard wearing a hoodie, right? And no, it's a team. There are in a variety of different compositions for the military and the intelligence community where it starts. But essentially, it's an operator or a team of operators. There's normally what's called an exploitation analyst or cyber planner who's planned out this mission. You just don't go kind of cowboy behind a keyboard. So there's a lot of planning. There's a lot, because of the sensitive nature of these operations, there is a whole lot of planning. And so by the time you actually start to do an operation, it's pretty much somewhat understood what your intent is, what the goal is, what the landmarks are, what the rules of engagement, what you are and you're not going to do by the time you hit that enter button. But now that engagement through the operator, through the keyboard, through the monitor, and as I mentioned, let's just say a command line, right? Connecting their cognition into a command line and then now being in an adversary's computer. There is so much data to visualize, to process. You're looking for threats. You're looking for indications that you may get compromised or your tool may not work. The difficulty is, I think no one necessarily wants to compromise a mission, right? No one wants to, you know, especially some of these operations can be months and years of planning or that they've been involved. And also these tools are very unique and they're very expensive. And so if you hit that enter button as a team, right? So there's some metacognition. How does the team think together? How do they as a team understand the risks? And if you hit that enter button and you make that mistake, you're probably going to be thinking about it at night. And then so those are some of the other aspects of sort of cyberspace operator syndrome, is that rumination. What did I do? Because they're perfectionists, they're always thinking sort of in the matrix. By the time, you know, I submit that a lot of the operators leave the keyboard and start going home, their minds are still in that operation of thinking about what they did. Did they do the right command? Did they really interpret what they saw on the screen? So there's a huge psychological impact that is very similar to an infantryman having to defend themselves or take out an objective.
If I can relate that back to kind of the corporate environment, and those who are listening to the podcast or watching it might kind of say, well, I think about my work when I head home. And I think the difference is that when you're working in a corporate environment at a desk behind a computer screen, lives aren't at stake and they aren't, you aren't destroying people's homes and their livelihoods and people. So I think there's a massive difference between the two areas, but there's, I can kind of get what you're saying in terms of the rumination. A lot of people think about work when you're going home because you've spent the whole day thinking about it. So you just ruminate about what you're doing. But it's on a completely different level when you are operating at that interactive operator in a cyber warfare context.
Yeah, and I was meant to, in the cybersecurity world, depending on the individual, depending on the culture of an organization, right? Like Todd Fletcher is focusing, or his research is, well, why do some SOC analysts just don't care when they see the alerts? Are they just burnt out? Why is it that they see that the lights are flashing red, indicating danger, and they're just kind of burnt out? I think for most part, cybersecurity, it's a huge investment. It's a constant landscape. You just don't go to school and you're done and you understand the trade and you kind of get better OJT. I would say that most cybersecurity professionals are constantly learning because technology is always changing. Just the technology itself and what you may be an expert in routers or in switches or in databases, well, that technology is getting upgraded. So there's always going to be bugs. There's always going to be something inherently wrong going on it. And then you have an adversary, a cyber criminal, who's trying to get into that network. And so you're also, because you're human, you're also trying to think, well, what did I do wrong? What did we misconfigure? What didn't we see? But I submit that they come to work. They're also inundated in that life and what may be going on in that organization. And then having to go back, and many of these individuals, as part of my study and others that have been shown, that you're done with work. By the time you get home, you eat, you spend some time with family, and then you're back on the books. Then you're back online studying and on the blogs because you're trying to get better. And there's this sort of never-ending spiral of trying to get ahead of the technology and get ahead of the adversary. And I don't think you can easily just turn that off.
Yeah. We need to be nicer to our cybersecurity people and corporate. Be nice to them. Bring them cake.
Give them a hug.
Give them a hug. If not, bring them cake. There's a concept that you said is an essential part of the work, which is the extended mind, where a person is almost mentally disembodied through their engagement in their cyber-based work. In some ways, we can all relate to this experience in terms of getting lost in an endless social media scroll. But obviously, this is different. There's a different psychological risk for those in cyber warfare. Can you talk a little bit more about the extended mind and what the impact this would have on interactive operators?
No, brilliant. Thank you. That is something that I finally stumbled across as a PhD student, right? This never-ending research. And going down these rabbit holes. And maybe about 2 months ago, after rereading this book about two or three times and highlighting it, at that point in my research, I'm like, okay, I see all the studies, either military studies like the ones I mentioned from the Air Force that have said, yes, occupationally, cyber operators get burnt out. They have psychological because of the hours and the shifts and maybe being sitting so long and being stagnant to the occupational. Maybe their leadership doesn't understand what they do. And so there's organizational sort of psychology that impacts the operators. And so that's pretty well understood. And I said, okay, I got that. So that's a good part of my research. And then there is some research, too, that's done by IARPA. It's a U.S. agency that's actually studying how do we find methods to impose not only a technical but a psychological toll on cyber operators. How do we tire them out? And just a way to be able to sort of stop the cyber attacks, if you would, for lack of better words. And so that research was really interesting. I'd been looking at it for about 6 months of it focused on cognitive biases. How do we understand an individual's cognitive bias and how do we interrupt that? How do we understand an operator or a hacker's decision-making? And then how do we say, okay, but that isn't the, how do we understand, how does an operator engaged in cyber operations online? That is the meat and potatoes of it, if you would, similar to an infantryman running in the desert or in the forest or a fighter pilot in an aircraft in the air. That we understand. We understand the physiology, the impact of that. And so I kept on always relating it to the movie The Matrix, right? When we see sort of those characters going into this little green web of lines coming down on the screen. And so that has been part of sort of trying to understand that, because it came from a movie. I didn't quite know the words of what it meant to go into this flow, right? So that's another theory that helped illuminate sort of this understanding that once you're behind the keyboard, once you're engaged in the sensitivity, you kind of lose track of time and space. And essentially your mind becomes part of that screen in whatever you're engaged in. And as a recent reading of the book by Dr. Parsons, it is called Cyberpsychology and the Brain. He had a section on there when he starts to explain from a cyberpsychology perspective, extended mind, and putting and tying that to technology. So essentially, it is how we, outside of our brain, extend our cognition with tools. So the calculator, paper, even our fingers, when, you know, many of us use our fingers to count. Well, why are we doing that? Shouldn't we be able to do that inside of our minds? But so this extended mind theory. And I said, okay, well, let me see how that, in just thinking through the process, how did that apply into cyber operation? And it was just kind of one of those aha moments going, this is it. This is what it actually means when a cyber operator, his tools, again, his or hers, are the keyboard, the mouse, the screens, and then the cyber tools, which married up with extended mind. And I said, okay, well, the next level that isn't necessarily in books or in any literature is then when an operator is actually, their tools are in an adversary's computer, and you are essentially cognitive-wise, right? Your mind, you're disembodied, virtually disembodied, and you're in that individual's computer. So I'll stop there.
But it's kind of, in my head, I kind of think about it as virtual reality, when you are kind of transported mentally into the space that isn't your body. So you're kind of going mentally into it. And Mary Akin talks about that in her book, The Cyber Effect, about how we actually enter into a completely different world. And we do that when you're in social media, you're entering into the space that is not physical, but you are there, even though your body is physically in your living room, and we operate, we live in two different spaces. So yeah, it's fascinating how we can be in two places at the same time without leaving our sofa.
Well, and so that's now a huge part of my research, right? So I pivoted a little bit, maybe about 2 or 3 months ago. I had received my IRB, Institutional Review Board approval. I had spent about 6 months putting together my study. It was probably about 99 pages by the time I submitted my IRB, because it had a lot of questions. I had a lot of biographical data that I needed to understand, not only about, you know, a cyber operator, but a cyber operator that was in the Navy, in the Air Force, in the Marine Corps, in Space Force, Coast Guard, those that were involved in the intelligence community. What sort of was their military career? What levels of operations that they did, and then just trying to ask a variety of questions of those that I just kind of pointed that came from the literature review, trying to ask again, and then ask some things about like the dark triad, ask about online disinhibition. From the cyber operator's perspective, right, my participants, what does anonymity mean to them? What does it actually mean? And again, quoting or tying this back to cyber psychological principles, you know, to have a persona, a personality, to embody, right? Because a lot of this work is actually anonymous, which is some of the aspects that can lead to hypervigilance. And then as of recent, I had to go back and modify my study and ask these questions about extended mind. And then hopefully developing what I think, you know, right now is just an hypothesis, which will be sort of a cognitive cyber presence. What is it actually? Not only, so it's a building off of extended mind theory, but now you're not only directly engaging what is physically with you to enter the cyberspace, but then also now be virtually, but somewhat physically, in an adversary's or target's computer. Which, here's a very interesting aspect of it. By hitting that enter button, you can open or close wow, I'm going to date myself, the CD tray on the computer. You can actually, turn on the camera. You can actually then go from the physical to the online to the physical world and make it do something.
So, Eric, outside of what we've spoken about so far, what are the main things you've learned to this point in your PhD journey, and what are you hoping to achieve from your research and work in operational cyber psychology amongst interactive operators?
Wow. So I've actually learned a lot, which is the beautiful part of this experience, right? And in particular, pursuing a PhD post a career, a 29-year military career, and wanting to be able to answer and get at some issues, personal, professional. And in essence, this PhD is more personal than professional as it relates to folks, the individuals that I work with, that I care about, and also from a national security perspective, to ensure that we are prepared and that we can take care of our future operators. Within that, it is looking at concepts like operational cyber psychology. How do we better develop the understanding of, again, what does it mean to conduct cyber operations through online, and how do we understand that psychological and cognitive impacts, and then how do we mitigate? How do we assess and select future operators? How do we train them? How do we maintain them? How do we employ them? And then also, how do we off-ramp them out of these roles where they can then go and have a successful life? So I've learned a lot. A lot of the research in cyber psychology actually has opened some great ideas for future work in national security. Having a 19-year-old, I still see my son coming up and down the steps on his phone, and I'm still looking at the principles of psychology and cyber psychology to go, what is making, this young man not be able to get off the phone? So there are some of those aspects that I'm interested in. And also, I think I had mentioned it, in insider threat. So how do we understand why is it that certain individuals do some potentially heinous, egregious crimes online? And how does that anonymity, how do these factors of engaging with cyber space bring that out, and how do we mitigate it?
And then from a future perspective, in terms of what are you hoping to achieve from in the real world from your PhD research going forward, and how do you see this growing to be something that's bigger than just the research that you're doing?
That's a great question. So hopefully we can, the DoD can look at, similar to what we have operational psychologists, how do we potentially hire or expand the understanding of our psychologists in cyber, right? Not that everybody needs to be a cyber psychologist, but I think in regards to, first of all, in cyber operations, if we're going to have support services psychologists all the way from how we assess and select them to how we maintain them to how we have psychologists be part of our operations, understanding the risks and the trauma that may be involved, that maybe we can further develop operational cyber psychology. Actually, a Dr. Jason Stalayada, he's actually on my committee, wrote a paper called Operational Cyber Psychology, Adapting Models from Special Operations. And so he initially came up with this in 2020. Interesting, he's actually part of my committee, helping me sort of develop this. So the first one would be operational psychology, cyber psychology. Secondly, it would be cyberspace operator syndrome. Let's get a handle and understand so we can develop occupational resiliency. We can better develop these operators for the future warfare. That, I think, is going to have an immediate impact. I'm happy to kind of say that some of my initial research from about a year ago has actually made it into what we call the National Defense Authorization Act, which is then levying certain requirements on cyber command or taking care of our cyber operators. Because it isn't only... we're not retaining them. They come in and then we're losing them after 4 and 5 years. And it costs almost $500,000, give or take, to develop an interoperable interactive operator. And we're losing them. right? And it isn't because they're leaving to go get high-paying jobs in Silicon Valley. Many of them are just burnt out, right? And this is just kind of my quick sway at it. So it is taking that into consideration. And then lastly, it would be how do we build technology? How do we build these tools from a human factors that then account for, again, some of what's coming out in the research, this extended mind? What does it actually mean to engage with the cyber tools in this military offensive cyber perspective?
This is really pioneering work and just putting down the foundations of what it means to operate in this area. That's extraordinary, brilliant. So you spoke about Todd Fletcher, who has been on the podcast before, and he's in the Psychology of Cybersecurity Professionals, so looking at preventing cyber attacks in business. And then I've also spoken to Dr. Marshall S. Rich about forensic cyber psychology, which is a different area to Todd's, which is investigating the psychology of bad actors and cyber attack perpetrators. So how is what you're researching different to what they're doing? Because that's a very different area of cyber psychology research compared to what they're doing. So where do you fit what you're doing into that map of cyber psychology?
I think we almost feed off each other. So interestingly, like, I know both of them. I speak to Marshall kind of every other day. He's been helping and guiding me along with Dr. Mary Edkins. Obviously, she's the head of our cyber psychology program, which first had to hear this pitch about 2 years ago. You want to do what with cyber psychology? And so, you know, that went well. I would say it almost makes like a pyramid, right? It's a perfect intersection. So Marshall and Melissa, she's another student from CapTech Technology, understanding cyber behavior analysis. Why and how do hackers actually, what is their motivation? Why do they do it? How do they do it? How do their personalities impact the decision-making? And so the opposite of that would be how do our operators, how do they think? What is their personality? So I've actually taken a lot of the research from many other amazing researchers, but to be able to pick up the phone and call Melissa and call Marshall and go, what did you focus on? So I can see the similarities, you know, what techniques did you do? And then being able to go, okay, well, this is completely different. You know, the motivations are different of a hacker than to someone who swears an oath, you know, to their nation to defend and to do these sort of operations. And then for Todd's work is very similar, where he's looking at the dark triad, the personalities. Well, again, hey, what did your research illuminate on the individuals that are actually defending, right? And a lot of that research is, well, how do I look at our individuals? So it's kind of like we can feed off each other, and we can augment, and hopefully that's what this research that's being illuminated, and it's going on in other places, that we can move this forward, right? But looking at it from a cyber psychological principle rather than like an IT or a cybersecurity perspective, and going, okay, we're some of us with the background and the experience, we're going to kind of come over to this side of the fence, which is the unique part. Maybe I should have started with that, is that because we come with hands-on experience, we come with problems that we want to solve, it really helps drive our research.
Yeah. And I think that's really great for all three of you, is that you've had that background and you know you're coming from a practical perspective and you've got questions and you can see the gaps and you're going, actually, this is something we really need to work on. It's not just about theory. It's not about just doing a PhD. This is about finding a solution and having a passion about finding that solution. And it sounds as though all three of you, and actually lots of other people in this field, are looking at different, it's like a prism of a diamond, really. We're saying this is a different angle we're looking at. And between us, we should come up with some really thorough research and ways of seeing the world from a cyber perspective, and especially when it comes to cyber attacks and cyber warfare and forensic cyber psychology. So.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, as you mentioned really briefly, there are so many other researchers. And so the neat thing about doing a PhD late into a career is that, you know, long story short, I can just pick up the phone and call a researcher, right? So I've actually made friends and acquaintances with researchers from Australia, from Spain, from Italy, from Norway, from just finding their research and going, aha, like, what were you thinking? What were you trying to solve? Why were you going down this you know, proverbial research rabbit hole? And let's talk, right? And then let's share it. Let's kind of feed off of each other. So all the way from, you know, there is another researcher, I think out of Italy or Spain, where they're putting probes, right, biofeedback devices on essentially an operator, a user who's playing Tetris, but also understanding sort of flow and what is, you know, this this cognitive connection to this game. How does it impact them physiologically? Because that's another part of this research that some are also studying, is the physiological impacts to this work. Just because you're sitting behind a computer, yes, your body hurts because you're maybe sitting in the chair for too long, or maybe it's not the position, but that stress, that cognitive load can also increase your heart rate, right? So there are some other researchers that are going, hey, we're studying, what is it? What is that physiological response to Facebook or being in VR or engaging in warfare? So it's just endless, I think. And it's kind of a beautiful thing to be able to start seeing, you know, this younger generation of researchers in whatever points of life that we are reaching out to each other and sort of helping one another move forward.
And you've spoken briefly about some of the different careers that you could possibly do in that spin off from operational cyber psychology. But what other areas do you think you could do? Are there any other things that you can think of that's others who are going into this area or wanting to go into this area can do? And about supporting interactive operators.
So for interactive operators, I think it's this research is my research is going to just, as my chair told me, hey, don't try to solve all the problems. Finish your PhD. Have a sticky list of things to do. One aspect of it, which is actually part of someone else who was very key in my research, Dr. Dijkstra. He used to work at the National Security Agency, and he had a paper that was also very illuminating. And in there, he spoke about, because he, in fact, was also an operator early on, talked about the physiological side of it, right? So I've only focused somewhat on the psychological, on the cognitive, and somewhat on the occupational side. What does it mean to be an operator in the military? I still think that can be researched. It's more the occupational side of it, organizational. And then, you know, there's also this physiological aspect of it. How do we ensure that, you know, the individual's body in correlation with the mind, that we look at that. So there's some physiological aspects I think that can also be looked at. And then there's, you know, the I believe that the next future in cyber operations is going to get even more complex, right? We're not only looking at conducting these operations and going into a server and bringing back documents, or looking at how do I destroy potentially an enemy's tank. But then there's going to also be other types of cognitive warfare, how to potentially operators now have to understand this unique world of, now you're going to be going after a human at the other end of a device. And now you're going to be potentially messing with their brain, with their mind. I think those are, you know, but we have to then understand the operator who's behind the keyboard and ensure that they can then do sort of working backwards what we're going to ask them to do, right? Not all operators, I think, are created equally as individuals. Some may love the focus on just hacking and getting into a computer and taking secrets. But it's a little bit different, even from a moral injury perspective, to go, you're going to be the person that hits enter, and at the other end, maybe a device explodes and potentially causes a kinetic harm. So that study, which has been kind of part of what we discussed with remote drone operators, is looking at this sort of kinetic aspect potentially to the future of cyber operations.
So if someone was looking to get into the field and they were listening to what you're saying and going, wow, that's interesting, I really want to go into this operational cyber psychology, it's a very specific field. So what do you suggest they study? What kind of career path do you think they should specialize in order to kind of find themselves or get into this field?
That's a good question. And we discussed it earlier, even just looking at the universities, right? I just stumbled across Capital Technology University, ended up going for cyber psychology. There was a few other fields that I wanted to be able to take what I had, my career in intelligence and in technology, in languages, and try to apply, kind of roll into another field without recreating the wheel, if you would. So I was fortunate to find Captech. It had a great program with cyber psychology that gave me the latitude to bring in this new problem into the space from a national security perspective, and talking to Dr. Mary Atkins, you know, and that worked out well. I still don't know an inventory of the different universities that offer cyber psychology. For example, Todd's, his program is not necessarily directly cyber psychology, but it is psychology, but he's leveraging it. And I think that today, just the title is transparent. I would say it's what you want to solve. And in particular, if you're at our point in our careers where you've had some form of a career and now you're trying to take that and move on, it's how do you get through the process without making it more difficult on yourself? And then how can, I think your research and having a plan to where you want to go, right? So I would love to be able to continue to work for the DoD, but I can easily take this and by the time I'm done with this and roll the principles of cyber psychology into online safety for children, or looking at cyber behavior analysis to stop future, you know, crimes, or morph it into the development of technologies. I think it's kind of providing yourself that flexibility and planning out a bit. Because as you know, as you start this research, there's going to be things that pop up and you're like, oh, that's a brilliant idea. And you try to go down that way. So I think it's a little bit of planning, but really then just doing it. Just going and saying, hey, I can afford this university. This university gives me the flexibility. I surround myself with smarter people than me. That would probably be the key thing, right? All the individuals on my committee are subject matter experts. And that has what's made this process for me successful.
And it is, it's about taking the step and just jumping in. And if you've got a burning question or something that you're really fascinated in, it's just doing research and having a plan and knowing what you want to achieve at the end of it. So yeah, I agree with you. Absolutely. Eric, we're coming to the end of our chats on this podcast. And there's three standard questions that I normally ask my podcast guests. And the first is, what is the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
So maybe, what don't I like about cyber psychology?
So what don't you like about cyber psychology?
It's endless possibilities. But it's quite endless possibilities. And it isn't quite fully established, which to me, psychology was probably something that I was interested when I first came into the military and decided I wanted to go to school. I said, hey, I'm going to learn psychology. Never went into it and just kind of pursued my military career. And funny enough, then later on, based on the impact and the toll of my service, I wanted to focus on psychology and cognitive psychology. But then as I looked at cyber psychology, it was just like, oh my God, this is just so difficult. Because of how the different focuses and how it's still being established, you know, I think we have a different way of looking at it or leveraging it in the United States differently than in the UK. Obviously, you know, folks like Dr. Campbell in Australia and other individuals of how they're looking at it. I think that's the hardest part of it is getting a grip on it. I can tell you that I can probably fill 2 or 3 pages on what cyber psychology is, but I think I know much less now than I actually did when I first started, just because it is just, it's kind of beautiful of how much it actually interconnects with everyday life, but how little is actually known about it.
Yeah. And I always say that, or I say it so often, that's the exciting things about cyber psychology is you can kind of create your own field in a way or own speciality in it because it's so new and there's so much that needs to be found out. And there's not enough people doing it. So it's so exciting, but also so frustrating at the same time.
It is, because depending on what you read, and sorry to cut you off, it's, and I think you've had a guest that spoke about it, it's not only depending on the definition, it's also that intersection of right human behavior and technology. And that's the one that I gravitated towards, which was not only online, which not only social media, was not only Facebook, Tinder, 4chan. You know, it wasn't only that. It was any of that intersection with technology from that perspective, right? Yes, most technology today connects to the internet. Crap, your refrigerator, your microwave, your vacuum cleaner, right? It connects to the internet. I think that's the neat part of it is, and that's allow folks to go, okay, well, I'm maybe looking at that psychology side of it, but this aspect of technology, for example, artificial intelligence, there's some amazing research that's coming out from, where do we really group artificial intelligence? Is that cyber? It doesn't matter. It is, how does a human interact with AI and then let somebody move forward with that research? And I think that's impactful. Is, again, how is that engagement with ChatGPT? How does that impact the human behavior? How does it, so that's fascinating research as well.
Absolutely. And then the second question is, there's often a frustration among cyber psychologists around the media misinformation, and where journalists often take academic findings and kind of distort it or change it slightly to foster clickbaits, create moral panic and negative social narratives around digital technology use. Do you think the media is getting better or worse at accurately representing sound academic findings?
That's an interesting question. I think I still struggle with it because I haven't researched it. I haven't looked into it. Everything that I've focused on the last two and a half years has been academic. Not necessarily, I barely even Google anything, so I don't see what pops up in the media. But I have looked at certain documentaries, right? And I would say probably, it's how the term hacker has, in many's eyes, first thing you hear is hackers. Well, they're a criminal. Well, not necessarily, right? Like, and so even in my study, the beginning of the study, I actually asked that association of an interactive operator, someone in the military, how did they associate with being a hacker, that creativity, that curiosity of how things work? But the media has been, if they don't use the right term, and to say it's a criminal cyber organization, it's a criminal, someone who's breaking the law for money. And that, I think, gets, that's troubling, right? Where there are individuals, young kids today, who are like, well, I love the curiosity of technology. I want to understand how it works. And then if the media goes, well, the hacker stole, they're attacking you, it's not necessarily the hacker, because most of the cybersecurity individuals trying to protect you associate with being a hacker. And that's a good thing. Well, what we're looking at is then those that fall into the group as black hat hackers that are criminal organizations, or, the various different terms, those are the malicious intent behind that curiosity and exploiting those vulnerabilities. So I think when the media automatically goes in pulls and says, well, the hackers, dark triad, okay, wait a minute, slow down, just articulate what you're trying to say, that it is a criminal organization, or it's a youth who is fascinated by hacking or by online games. I think you had a previous podcaster or a couple of them speak about, online gaming and the reality of what an online gamer is and what they're not, and some of the benefits of probably embracing the positives of hacking online gamers, but also understanding that there's some negatives. So I think it's the media's responsibility to be clearer on the terms of how we do it, because it can be dangerous.
Yeah, and it's about using the right terminology, and there's a lot of nuances that we kind of become familiar with as cyber psychologists, and I think the media has some element of responsibility of understanding those, and they don't. They just use a broad brush term to describe something, and then the general public who don't know as much kind of take their word for it and just take this on board, and it creates a lot of moral panic. And then suddenly in Australia, you've got this ban on social media for anyone under 16, and it's actually not all that good for you. So there's a huge responsibility that journalists have to understand those nuances and what those terms mean and stuff. So agree. The final question, Eric, is, do you have any cyber psychology related books, and particularly around your field that you're currently studying and researching? Are there any cyber psychology books or related books that you would recommend to those who are listening to this podcast?
Yes. So the first one that I read was actually by Dr. Mary Edkins, was Cyber Effect. That was the first one that I was able to read to get this understanding of what cyber psychology was. And then from an operational perspective, right, how she used cyber psychology, forensic cyber psychology, to attempt to look at crimes, right, at cyber crimes. And that for me was easy to relate to those examples. And so that was a good introduction while I was also looking at podcasts or reading literature review. There are several, I think I have bought in more books than I can physically read or highlight them. But the second one that was the most impactful, because it helped me get to where I'm at in the research right now, was Dr. Parsons' Cyber Psychology and the Brain. And so this one, I need to talk to Dr. Parsons and go, what were you thinking? How were you trying to research of how something on online impacted a certain part of my brain, right? And that one was eye-opening in two perspectives. First of all, was because he covered extended mind theory and how it related to technology. And then from that, I was able to get that aha moment, and it drove my research. And then secondly was, how did certain interactions with online or cyberspace impact the brain in certain regions of the brain, which I am not even going to attempt to speak about. But for me, it related to, for at least for the military, those who have had traumatic brain injuries, or there have been studies where the same MRIs that I sat inside for looking at traumatic brain injury have also been used to look at those that have internet disorders or gaming disorders, and they were able to find certain regions impacted by that disorder. So that also led me to go, okay, sticky note, get to future research on how maybe we look at cybersecurity professionals, we look at interactive operators, and how that engagement, that deep engagement with online, has impacted their brain, because that's another way to potentially, from a health perspective, is go, okay, we're gonna care about the beautiful minds of these individuals. So those two books have been, first, you know, Dr. Murray's was the first one that kind of gave me the vision. And then now lately is Dr. Parsons, how it associates with the brain, and then the ethical considerations, his second book on the ethical considerations of online cyber psychology.
Brilliant. Thank you for those recommendations. It's awesome. And Eric, thank you so much for joining me at Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It's been so wonderful to catch up with you and find out more about what you're doing in this incredible new area of cyber psychology. And thank you for the work you're doing. Thank you for the research you're doing. And I do hope we get to chat about what you're doing in the future, especially when you finish your PhD. And when you've written your first book, because I'm quite sure there'll be plenty of stuff coming from you in the future.
Thank you, Karen. I appreciate the opportunity.